Roxy from Brigade. I'll be connecting your phoner with Tony Gilroy today.
All right.
All right. Let's see, you both should be on the line now.
Okay.
Jeffrey?
Hey, Tony. How are you?
Hello. I'm good, man. How are you?
It's a good day. It feels like a good day. I wanted to see Beirut one more time because, I saw it last January in that great, really beautiful screening that they had at the Eccles that you described, actually, in that interview you did not too long ago. But I guess I'll see it afterwards, and then I'll just polish up my impressions. But my my basic impression was the same as everybody else's, but it's so lovely to see a good Tony Gilroy-authored film. Done right, done in a clear, adult, complex way. You can actually follow the plot. You can veins of eloquence and feeling, and second act plot pivots, and the payoffs coming at the right. Everything, the denouement, very beautifully written.
Thank you.
Thank you. And
Brad did a really good job. I think Brad did an amazing job in the film.
Very well written. Very well directed. Excuse me, Brad. Absolutely, I totally agree.
Yeah, no. And like for nothing. I mean, like nothing. I bet there were films at Sundance that cost more. seriously, films that were like there to find, little indie. I can't tell you what it cost, but like it's death-defying, the number and how they did this.
And how many days did they shoot Beirut within? How many?
I don't know exactly, but it was like nothing. I don't know. It's under 30 in Tangier.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know exactly. Don't pin me down. I don't know exactly, but
I love the whole, I can remember back in my New York days that there was a bar that traded on the mystique, the dangerous mystique of Beirut. I think it was literally called Downtown Beirut. Do you remember that place?
There was an after-hours club called Beirut.
Yeah.
Down in Alphabet City, yeah.
Yeah. That's something that everybody understands, the word Beirut. It's ever since the early 80s, mid-80s, it's been known as a place that, carries a certain amount of rubble and ruin and danger and various tribes, etc. And yet...
Well, did you ever see Circle of Deceit?
Actually, no, I didn't.
The Volker Schlondorf film?
No.
Okay.
I never saw it.
I don't have to rush here, so I'm not gonna because you're the only person, like one of the only people that I'll talk to that this will matter to. Mm. But you should. When I was writing this, there was no DVDs, and like I was looking for films to put me in the place, and there were some documentaries, and there were some different things. But I kept reading about this Circle of Deceit that Volker Schlondorf had shot this movie with Bruno Ganz and Hannah Shigula in Beirut in 1982, and Sam Cohn represented Volker Schlondorf, and I was like, that's how I babied into the, they were my first agents, and my agent was next door to his office. He didn't have a print. No, he had a print. They had a print in Kansas City in a vault. Like, I guess there's some film vault that they had where they kept prints.
Mm.
And they, Robert Corda, the Interscope, said, we'll send the print to New York and you can screen it. It was very glamorous. Like, I was like, okay, fine. I'm going to have a screening. So I invited all these friends to come see the screening of this movie that was going to be in the Brill Building. And, like, nobody could show up. Like, nobody could make it. I end up going by myself. I sit there. I watch this film, which is fucking staggering.
Mm.
It's unbelievably the back lot that he uses. The thing. I come out of the screening. The projectionist... You know how bored projectionists are. Guy comes out of the projection booth and goes, "What was that?" So this guy and I are the only two people who've seen it. I think it's been subsequently. I don't know if it's on Apple TV or what it's on, but man, if you ever get a chance to see it, you will not believe what that city really looked like in 1982 and how he shot this movie. Hannah Shigula and Bruno Ganz. Yeah, amazing film.
Yeah, I'm completely sold, and I am going to make a point of seeing it almost immediately. That sounds
really
good.
You will really dig it.
I take it then
it
wasn't just the atmosphere and the milieu. I take it there was something about the way the film was made that was partially an inspiration to yourself as you were writing your own Beirut movie.
No? Well, I wasn't. been able to, I mean, I think they kind of went there and found the movie and lost their minds. I'm not sure. It was so dangerous what they were doing. But I wanted to see, because I couldn't go.
Yeah.
I couldn't go there then.
Right.
And I was, even then, I was so young and naive about doing these things. But even then, I knew that, like, I had to, that going to the place was critical. And so I really spent a year in research, doing everything I possibly could to make sure that I understood where I was. And so movies like that were really important.
When you say you spent a year in research, you're talking about your period when you were running it as a sort of an in-house
Interscope. Yeah, it took me a whole year to do it.
Right? Yeah.
What?
Interscope. When you
were... because there was no internet. It was...
Yeah.
It was books. It was going to the Strand. It was going to the public library. It was going to the, you know, newspaper files. What did they used to call that thing with the newspaper... Oh, I can't remember what it was. What the all the old research, the old ways.
Yeah, I know. I know the term you're talking about. That it just escaped my mind, also. But
yeah, no, I know. Well,
Nexus, Lexus Nexus, right? Wasn't that?
No, it was before that. It was when things were on microfiche and microfilm. And
okay.
You'd go to the anyway. Mm. Yeah. So it took a long time to research and write it. Yeah.
Now, I know that, you know, you're a script and everything, but you're also listed as producer, but you were right in the middle of Rogue One when they were shooting this? Was that how it worked? Right?
They made me a producer. We couldn't even find, it's so old, we couldn't find my contracts, and there was no way to get paid or anything. It was a way for them to, it was a way for me to get a little bit paid, and then also to sort of be able to hang my head high and really help them out, you know. And so I really wasn't a day-to-day producer. I went for the weekend before they started shooting and the table read and the thing. But I wasn't around while they were shooting. And but I did a lot of work in post, and I did a lot of work beforehand, getting actors involved and helping people out, and you know, all the things that you know you would do. And I rewrote this. You know, and I took a pass on the script as well.
Were you, so you updated it a little bit, you're saying, right?
Yeah, you know, it was, I mean, I never believed they were going to get it off, so I mean, I read it when they said we were going to go for John and Brad Anderson, and would you be involved, and I just never thought that they would get anything done. It was it was such an insane prospect, and then when I read it, I was like, oh, this is kind of good, and John Hamm would crush this, and if they ever get serious, I'll go back and make a pass at it. And then finally, I was put up or shut up. I was like, oh my God, they're really going to make this thing. So I sort of vaingloriously said, oh, well, I'll make a quick pass. And then it took me so much longer to do it. And it's not really that different. I don't know what the hell I did and what took me so long. But I'm just a slightly different writer than I was 30 years ago. And it was a sort of interesting thing to work with yourself. Imagine. Go back and rewrite something you rewrote 30 years ago. Pretty weird, right?
I'll tell you.
I mean, you know how you've evolved over 30 years, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's so...
pretty weird.
It's so affecting to me that I, you know, the term old school has been applied to it in the most flattering way imaginable, because it really is such a satisfying feeling to be enmeshed in something that really has clearly been worked on, and yet it's not rushed. And it's not chaotic, and there's not the usual action beats that you feel that filmmakers have to go to because audiences expect a certain frenzied experience.
Right.
You know, it's
exactly
it's so wonderful.
I know.
To feel that kind of thing.
But this used to be. There used to be. I mean, this would have been a very ordinary. You know, it was meant to be a Sidney Pollack movie. It was meant to be. You know, it was written for you know for Peter Weir or Wolfgang Peterson. It was you know Michael Douglas or
right.
Bruce or Mel Gibson. It was written. You know, in that context, in 1991, it would have been a much more expensive. It would have much more time to shoot. It would have probably been a much more lavish production, and it would have been a much more ordinary film. There were a lot of films like this then. It was not an unusual film in 1991, really.
Early 90s were a quite different atmosphere, of course, in this industry. And,
but Year of Living Dangerously was the model. And,
yeah.
I don't know. There were movies like this, you know.
So why you? I think you said in the previous interview that I listened to, that I excerpted, that there was some... problem that you took it around, of course, to everyone, and they seemed to have a problem with what they detected as some sort of anti-Israeli or not pro-Israeli enough or something like that.
Well, look, the villains. There's three villains in this thing. You know, I'm not kind to the PLO. Accurately saying, you know, the PLO had, right. you know, first class in economy, and it's corrupt, and you know, the leadership is over in West Beirut, and the you know, there's 600,000 people in settlements that are waiting to go home, and so there's a disconnect there. I'm saying that the Reagan White House is just a rat fuck of you know, mistaken motivations and blinking green lights and just a mess, and that's accurate. And then I'm also being, you know, really, really accurate about Israel's moment of darkness there, where they're just looking for any goddamn excuse they possibly can to invade. And right. those things were all really, really true, and they've all those trials have all been settled in the interim. I mean, by the time I went to research it again, I mean, all the things that were controversial before all been established fact.
Right.
But at the time, you know, people were still sensitive about some of this stuff. And it was just enough sensitivity, and the stuff was so baked in that you couldn't really pull it out and change it. But, you know, a lot of people just said, well, we tried. And but man, it changed a lot for me. It was a really important script. It got me, it put me in a much higher, you know, it moved me up in class. And, you know, the only movie that I had made was an ice skating movie at that point. And all of a sudden, this was like, oh, I'm a serious, you know, this guy's maybe he's serious. And it got me Dolores Claiborne. And, but, you know, it just, you know how you do. You, you try to get in a better, try to get in a better class. So it helped me out, but it was just a little too stinky for everybody at that point.
Now Ham was already on this thing when they came to you and said, do you want to be, you know, can you work with us and help out a little bit?
I can't remember because it was Ted Field and this guy Mike Weber who works for him. I mean, they're really, Mike really is the, he's really a producer on this. I mean, he really dug it. I can't remember if they said, we're going to go to John. I think they was, we're going to go. Do you mind? Will you help us go to John? Will you help us go to John and Brad? Will you endorse that? Because that's what the kind of thing, to write a letter to the agent and write a letter to John and do those kind of things. And,
well, it's by far, I completely agree with the Variety guy. I said it's easily the best role that Ham has had since Mad Men. It's the first really good movie star role he's had, and he's done some wonderful supporting work and character work, and he's really game for a lot of things. But when I saw this, I said, this is what he has, you know, this is that moment that I've been waiting to see him in ever since Mad Men came to an end. So it's really...
Do you think he's free of that now? Does this liberate him? I hope so.
I think so, yeah, definitely.
God, I hope so. I mean, it's so... I just did this, you know, someone asked me about this morning, and sort of go, God, what a... You know, to do such a body of great work, it's like James Gandolfini in Sopranos. You go like, wow, do you get punished for building up one of the biggest bodies of excellent work anyone's ever done, and now you're trapped there? Really.
Well, that's pretty common. That's happened to a lot of people, as you know. You really make a strong impression in one particular way, and people, you know, don't get too good at something. They won't let you do anything else.
Well, I hope this is nothing would please me more than if this gave us another legitimate movie star that you could go out and raise money on. That would be fantastic.
What is the glamorous I want to work with Tony Gilroy thing that everybody has when you take meetings these days? Does everybody say
you got to be kidding, Jeffrey?
No, I'm serious. People don't say the Michael Clayton guy. They don't say this is the guy who did one of the great.
You know, I don't know what they say. I don't get out much, man. I think most people have a warped idea of what it's really like. It's not like that. I mean, I don't know. I still have to grind, man. I have to prove it. I have a lot of trouble getting movies off. I tried to get a bunch of original movies off in the last couple of years, and I've been very, you know, clearly unsuccessful. It's tough, man.
Well, people. I mean, you know, my history, the whole Michael Clayton thing, which I will always be ashamed of, which is that I wasn't quite there the first time, and it got better for me the second time. And by the fourth viewing or the fifth viewing, it's one of the greatest films I've ever seen in that kind of uptown business genre ever. You know, it's great.
Well, all right. I think you should stop watching it now. don't do anything else.
That's funny.
Just stop where you are right now, because the worm could turn. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, it's, look, I'm trying to do original, unbranded IP, man. I mean, it's really,
yeah,
you know, it's tough out there. Mm. It's tough.
Are they coming back for you for... What's going on with the Bourne thing? Are they doing one more? Is that what I've read somewhere or something?
God, I literally have no idea. I don't really know. I don't... I'm so out of the... I'm out of the circle. I don't... I have no idea what they're doing. They've so squandered that whole genre, the whole world, I think. I have...
Mm-hmm.
I think there was so much opportunity there that's been...
The genre has a time, you know. It has a right time in history, and it's the right thing to see at that time. And you can't keep making these things, I guess.
No, but they could have built a world around it. We tried to give them an opportunity and legacy to build a world, you know, a Marvel universe.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of, you know, my whole goal there was to put a candle in the window and try to expand it and keep it alive and present some. Hopefully open opportunities, but...
One thing I felt during the last Bourne film was that I couldn't believe that they were going back to the CIA guys looking at screens and saying, that's him! There he go! Get him! I got so sick of that back-and-forth dynamic. I just wanted to see something else, and that was a big mistake, I felt.
Yeah, I didn't see the very last one, so I'm...
You didn't see it? You weren't. You must have been fascinated.
I was warned not to see it. I was told. My brother called me and said, "I don't. Maybe you shouldn't watch it."
All right.
I haven't seen it yet. Maybe one of these days I'll watch it on a plane or something. I don't know.
Can I confess something? I never saw The Great Wall, even though I should have, because you were one of the writers.
No. Well, can we go off the record?
Okay.
You don't like to go off the record? Then I'm not going to talk about it.
I can cut it out. It's easy enough. We're near the end of our 15 minutes anyway, so.
I'll stretch it out a minute. But anyway, I would say don't see it. You're not missing anything.
All right.
Okay. Off the record. I don't want to badmouth the movie. I got to name my name on it.
Yeah.
There's nothing there.
Yeah. Okay.
Long story.
How about the surely the Disney people must be wanting to get you engaged in some kind of... I know that you're not a Star Wars guy. You don't really have a big passion for that. But you did such a good job, and Rogue One has such a good, you know, reputation. They must be asking you to get involved in something else down the line. No?
They're amazing. I mean, they were amazing and very happily, you know, very happy experience for everybody, I think, in the end. There has to be something that's right for me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So far there hasn't been anything that's right for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really a natural, like, Star Wars legacy guy, you know, but now maybe they're going to liberate, it was going to be really wide open before, and then it got really tightened up, but now that Disney's making its own pipe, I think they're going to go wider again. Boy, the trailer this morning for the Han Solo looks fantastic, I thought. I was really impressed.
No, actually, I kind of liked it myself, yeah. But I still don't...
In spite of yourself, right? I know.
I mean, even though the...
Look pretty damn good.
The Alden Ehrenreich thing is just wrong. I mean, they should have used the guy from Baby Driver. He would have been perfect.
I mean, you know what, Jeff? Let me finish with this. Let me finish with this bit of... Because I've been thinking about this all weekend. Because, you know, I did this little thing with Brian, and it got blown out of proportion. And, like...
You're talking about the interview that I listened to? Go ahead.
But it makes it... The internet makes movie making so much more difficult.
Uh-huh.
We used to be in a world where, you know, you'd make a movie, and if it was interesting enough or big enough, maybe there'd be an after-action report or a forensic book or something, how Gone with the Wind got made, or... Mm. You know, and everybody profits by that. We learn about our lore, and you learn what not to do, and it's all interesting. But the idea of dissecting the patient while they're trying to run a marathon is terrifying. I mean, Kathy Kennedy has to try to make movies with dozens of millions of people screaming at her 24 hours a day in every time zone around the world. It's really, really difficult to do. Alden Ehrenreich has to give his performance, try to do a performance with, like, if he ever looked down or ever checked the chat rooms, he'd never leave his trailer. I don't know how, you know.
I understand that.
I was trying to write, I was trying to write, at the beginning of all this madness, I was trying to write, Born. And a journalist called me up who had, like, wanted to do a story about something that we were doing, and they had some information, and it was really not helpful. And I said to them, you know, can you imagine, I said, we're literally trying to write this right now. Can you imagine trying to write with 100,000 people staring over your shoulder? It's like, please don't crush us. And, like, Star Wars is the most dizzying, I'm always astonished. I was astonished this weekend when I looked at this, like, little 2 minutes that I saw with Brian, how that blows up. This is massive. And the idea of trying to make movies while everybody is up your grill is really hard. Really, really hard. People should have really sympathy for the people that are trying to do this.
Well, I guess my only thought here is that I completely hear you, and I think that having everybody second-guessing you as you're trying to make it fresh and natural and come from some deep place within yourself, I completely understand and sympathize with that. But if I were Kathy Kennedy and I didn't like the way things are going, I think I probably would have decided what to do about it without waiting 4.5 months. You know, that's the strangest.
Yeah, but you know what? I wonder what, if you go back and look at the history of Gone with the Wind, what that would have looked like with 33 million people responding every day to every single thing that happened.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think it warps your decision-making process in some way. It makes you it can't help but bend your process. It really, it's kind of dizzy.
Okay.
Yeah, man, it's tough, but... Anyway.
Well, here's Hollywood Elsewhere hoping for the next Tony Gilroy masterpiece to come out within a couple of years anyway. And I really love your writing, and I think it's one of the best written Middle Eastern thrillers I've ever seen, and just thumbs up in general.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you. It means a lot. And watch Circle of Deceit.
I'm absolutely doing that before the weekend.
Okay, brother.
All right, take care.
Always good to talk to you, man. Be well.
All
right.
Bye.